Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Get your advanced PhD in WOW from Floor and Decor. If you're a pro, you're already an expert in tile, wood, and stone. And with Floor and Decor's job site delivery, their free design services, and pro rewards that actually reward you, your business is set to grow from one client to the next. Floor and Decor isn't just a couple of aisles. It's an entire store designed to help your business boom. It's Floor and Decor. Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. Well, thanks to digital technology, modern life often promises us a world full of limitless possibilities where you'll never have to be bored again. But what if that promise of limitlessness and freedom actually contributes to our lives feeling dull, flat, and full of anxiety? And what if embracing constraints and even boredom can give our lives more texture and heft? Well, that's what my guest today argues in his book, Play Anything. His name is Ian Bogost. He's a professor of philosophy and, get this, a video game designer. Today on the show, Ian and I discuss why modern life often can be filled with existential angst, why we live in an age of irony that's supercharged by the internet, and how looking at the world as a metaphorical playground can help you feel more grounded and present in reality. This show is full of counterintuitive wisdom and ready-to-work tools that can help you live a more fulfilling life. After the show is over, check out the show notes at aom.is/bogost. That's spelled B-O-G-O-S-T. Ian Bogost, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
So you got a great book out. It's called Play Anything, The Pleasures of Limits, The Uses of Boredom, and The Secret of Games. And really is one of the best books I've read this year. Because you hit on a lot of topics and ideas that I've sort of felt and sort of couldn't articulate about our modern day. So I love it. But before we get into the book, let's talk about your background, because I think it'll help listeners get an idea of where you're coming from, and also your background is just really dang interesting. You're a philosopher, professor of media studies, and a video game designer, which is two things you don't see paired together every day. So how did that happen? How did you become a philosopher / video game designer?
Yeah. I mean, it's actually not as weird as it sounds, but I admit it does sound very strange. And it's not as weird as it sounds, because actually there's a long history of philosophers who worked in other media, as artists and creators, especially as novelists, as playwrights, Sartre, Rousseau, Nietzsche, Duchamp, Marcel Duchamp, who's more well known as an artist, eventually became a master chess player later in life. So sometimes it goes the other way too, which isn't necessarily to like associate myself with folks of that level of prestige, but just to sort of suggest that there is this long history of philosophy and art intersecting. And often it's because, in games or in novels or in painting or in chess, even, you see aspects of the abstract world, which is what we think about when we think about philosophy and philosophical questions. They become concretized, and that's one way of bringing those worlds together. But as far as me myself, I mean, my background is not necessarily that of this sort of two universes that never meet, but the question of like what does technology have to do with arts and culture, and how do those worlds converge? It's kind of always been the interest for me since I was a kid, even. And games are a particularly interesting kind of computer technology, precisely because they were some of the first elements where computation became cultural. Entertainment became a place where we tried to do something other than work with machines, and that's always been interesting to me. But also, like, games offer this kind of way of getting underneath some of the assumptions that we make. They're these interesting philosophical playgrounds. They kind of offer this strange, skewed weird view of everyday life, you know, like you take a field and you add a ball and some lines to it, and that transforms it into a soccer pitch, into something totally different. Or you take some, you know, some cubes that are spotted with dots and you hurl them onto a green felt, and that becomes something entirely different, this trial for chance and wagers. Or even, you know, you stick four squares together in different patterns and make them fall on a screen, and that becomes Tetris. So games are like this, this place where we trick ourselves into seeing and then working with things that we'd otherwise overlook. And games certainly aren't the only way to do that. But as I've sort of moved through my career as a philosopher and a game designer, it's become clear that that's one of the features of games that's most interesting and kind of most relevant to both domains.
Right. So, I mean, your focus in philosophy, is it games? Sort of like, I mean, it's like Wittgenstein, right? Like wrote about games, right? If I remember from my philosophy.
Wittgenstein
mind.
Had used games as an example of a particular problem with language, right. Because there's this challenge with the word games, so we don't really know what it refers to. And games were an excellent example of a concept Wittgenstein called family resemblance. You know, what different games have in common is not that they're all instances of some superordinate category, but that they share these sort of overlapping features. Donuts are another example of that, by the way. It's sort of like what makes a donut is that it comes in the donut box, more or less. But my interest in philosophy is, I mean, you know, it's related to games when it is, but it's actually much higher level and a bit broader. The area of philosophy that's of particular interest to me is called metaphysics. And metaphysics is a field that addresses the fundamental nature of being. So metaphysicians ask questions like, what does it mean for something to exist in the first place? And what kinds of things exist, and what's the relationship between the things that do at some fundamental level, at a level that sits before even a science, before we begin engaging with how we might manipulate and understand the material world. And one of the problems in this discipline of metaphysics that I work on, which ends up being a theme of the book, and I should clarify that you don't need to know anything about philosophy to get it in the book. One of those themes is that people tend to think of themselves as being at the center of existence. And this is true even like centuries after the Copernican Revolution, even when we know that the universe is enormous and we're this tiny corner of it. Still, nevertheless, in philosophy and even in science, we tend to worry most about the relationship between people and other things, between ourselves or our communities and the rest of the world. And that makes sense because we're in our bodies and in our neighborhoods and in our countries and so forth. But in doing that, we tend to overlook all of the equally interesting and kind of powerfully weird stuff that happens in between other stuff, even the stuff that we humans have made. So there's this kind of infinite mystery in every toaster and on every freeway and in every big box store. And those problems at a philosophical level are of great interest to me. And there's some of the motivations for exploring the themes in the book.
Right. Well, we'll get into that idea that we're the sort of the center of the universe, how that kind of can lead us astray. But how has your philosophy career influenced your game design?
It's done so in a number of ways. So when I started working on games professionally, which is about 20 years ago, sort of at the rise of the internet, and some of the games that I worked on at that time that I had the opportunity to work on were very different than ordinary games. The internet made it possible to distribute stuff directly and, you know, without kind of the publishing apparatus that we were used to in store-bought materials. And I happened to be working in advertising at the time, so I got involved in sort of the early days of applying games to marketing and advertising. And this was, you know, interesting enough at the time. But one of the questions I began asking myself then was, well, you know, I mean, what other kinds of purposes could games be put to? You know, this is a kind of business use of an entertainment medium that we tend to associate with kids, or we certainly don't associate with utility. And we, you know, there'd been a long history of games as educational tools by that time. You know, everyone probably played Oregon Trail or other games like that in the 80s and 90s. And that was one possible use. And I began thinking about the relationships between those kinds of uses and wondering what others there might be. So I began working very extensively in games about kind of social issues and politics at my studio, we made the first official presidential campaign game for Howard Dean. And in 2003, we worked on games about all sorts of strange issues you wouldn't think of seeing in games, like tort reform and errand running and educational policy. And we made some games about like airport security and the time when all of the TSA stuff was happening. And the sort of philosophical motivation for some of those questions was, you know, the field of rhetoric, the philosophical domain of rhetoric. How do you express ideas? How do you persuade people? How do you change their opinions? And games are different from speech or from writing or from images, in that in a game, you can model something about the world. You can kind of like make this little miniature copy of it that you can work with, that you can manipulate. And in so doing, at least this is my contention as a philosopher, as much as a game designer, in manipulating that little model of the world, you could experience something about like what it might be like to live in a version of the world if those ideas have been implemented. So it's kind of like a natural way of thinking about experimenting with social policy or with public policy or with just ways of behaving and living that are different from our own. Now, admittedly, like, you know, this use of games is still somewhat marginalized or hasn't become predominant in the commercial sphere, but it's a good example of one of the kind of underlying uses of games that like sits under the radar and yet nevertheless is taking place every day.
Awesome. And we'll talk about your game. I think we can talk about Cow Clicker, because I thought that was, or Click the Cow or whatever. Maybe we can talk about that later on.
Yeah, we can definitely talk. I mean, Cow Clicker is sort of my great infamy. So it's always worth bringing up.
All right. So let's talk about Play Anything, where you take insights from your career as a philosopher and game designer to make what, when I was reading it, I was thinking, this is a really countercultural case on how to make our modern enemy-filled lives more meaningful. But before we get to the prescription, let's talk about the cultural and philosophical problems you're trying to address in the book. So start off, like, what, and you mentioned it earlier, I think, but I mean, what are the underlying philosophical paradigms of our feelings of angst and frustration and restlessness that we have, that a lot of people experience these days?
Yeah, I mean, one of the biggest problems of modern life, I think, is that we live in this time of enormous surplus, enormous plenty. We have more than we ever have had before. We can get access to almost anything immediately. Information is so enormously accessible that it costs nothing to access it. But in spite of all this, we still kind of feel miserable, and we feel miserable more and more, and maybe even more intensely miserable, kind of the more surplus, the more plenty we seem to acquire. And this is kind of a paradox. You know, how is it that we ended up in a situation where provided all of the material wealth, relatively speaking, especially in the West, right? Plenty that we have access to, that nevertheless, we still feel like our lives are getting worse, worse and worse. And, you know, there have been attempts to ask questions about this problem before. One of the figures that I talk about a little bit in the book is the psychologist, Barry Schwartz, who wrote this book called The Paradox of Choice, maybe a dozen years ago. And, you know, one of his insights was that, when you have all these choices, then in theory, you should be more gratified because you have so many options. You have options for spouses and options for shampoo and mustard alike. But the problem actually is that the more options we have, then the more a bad choice becomes kind of your fault, and you internalize that sense of despair and of regret for having made what turned out to be a bad choice. And it was really only a bad choice because you felt like you had other choices. And you know, if you kind of extend that to the contemporary world, that condition hasn't gotten any better. In fact, it's only gotten worse. And online life has kind of amplified that, you know, in addition to infinite shampoos or mustards at the store. Now we have access to kind of almost anything. It's immediately accessible with almost no switching cost. And so we go through this anxiety of all of the options we have, all of the missed opportunities or the potential missed opportunities that we face almost constantly. It's the kind of thing that makes you hold off until the very last minute to make plans with people because you're just not sure if something better might come along. It's like we do that with everything. And in spite of all this, we seem at the same time to believe that a relatively small and maybe increasingly smaller number of things and people and activities could provide us with the contentment that we supposedly savor. And I think fundamentally this problem, it comes down to the idea of freedom, of our interpretation of what it would mean to be free. You know, we're obsessed with this idea of freedom, but we think it means escape. You know, if only I could kind of do what I want, then I'd be content. I just need to wrest myself out of this moil of stuff that I have to do that I don't want to do, and then on the other side of it, I'll find the things that that can provide me pleasure once I overcome the supposed nuisances or obstacles that are in the way. But then once we do so, those things that were supposedly going to bring us pleasure only become additional nuisances and obstacles. And so that becomes this sort of endless chain of misery. And that's the problem that we have to overcome. And to overcome it, as you know, as seems obvious once you start looking at the problem directly, we'd have to find a way of finding not just contentment or satisfaction, but joy and delight in all of those things that we previously characterized as nuisances, you know, all of the shopping trips and the commuting and the lawn mowing and the ordinary stuff of daily life.
Right. And I mean, and I guess, as you mentioned earlier too, all these choices and all these things, like, it puts us in the center of the universe, right? We live inside of our heads, and when reality doesn't match the ideal in our head, like, we get frustrated.
Yeah. Which it never does, because the world is outside our head actually. And you know, the sense of entitlement that we have, you know, not in the sense that, oh, I think I deserve a certain kind of a job or a certain kind of partner, but rather just the sense that we are owed some debt by the universe, and that it should respond to us in a way that gives us gratification. You know, this is a starting point of a whole set of anxieties, and this is also where anger and misery and even violence come from. But then to respond to that through negativity, through nihilism, to say, oh, well, you know, the universe is fundamentally unconcerned and therefore nothing matters, that can't be the answer. That can't be the answer either. It's understandable why we sometimes despair in that way, but we know exactly where that leads, and it doesn't lead anywhere good. So in the face of the knowledge that we are, that we live in this sort of, you know, secular age where we can't seek singular meaning outside of ourselves, whether it's in God or even in just culture, because culture is so multivarious now, then we need a way for all of those individual encounters with ordinary objects, ordinary things, ordinary people to bear meaning without that meaning having to be like produced from within us, without us having to invent it all the time.
Right. So it's kind of going against, it sounds sort of like you're going against existentialism a bit. Like, that's the one thing I find existentialism attractive, but then when you think about it, I was like, God, that's a lot of pressure. I got to like come up with meaning for my life. That's hard.
It's too much pressure. Nobody can do it. And if you try, you can do it for a little while, and then you become overwhelmed with the burden. And the funny thing about this solution, which is, I mean, one of the people I talk about pretty extensively in the book is the writer David Foster Wallace, and you know, this is one of the solutions that Wallace suggests, that you know, if we can kind of trick ourselves into thinking that you know, other people might have it worse off than I do, to kind of flip the bit on our sense of despair or of disorientation, then this is one way of attaching ourselves to something larger. And you know, like, this is just an impossible idea. It's nice to think about, and certainly there are moments in your life when you can calm yourself down, or you can kind of, you know, resist ratcheting up a conflict or something by imagining that the, you know, the person in front of you at the supermarket line is taking a long time, you know, has some difficult challenge they're facing in their lives, and you should just chill out. But that's just doomed to failure as a matter of course. It's just a huge, enormous burden. And even despite the temptation maybe to pursue that kind of logic, like, why would we even have to? Like, why make up stories about the world as you might imagine it to be, when instead you could look at the world and see how much it has to offer for you to work with? And this requires, you know, a kind of different way of looking and then responding. to the things we find around us every day, which is really the fundamental idea in the book, that you can play anything. And, you know, what I mean by that is that anything whatsoever can become a source of delight and pleasure if you work with it and treat it for what it is.
Right. And yeah, that's, I thought it was an interesting argument you made with David Foster Wallace. Because that whole idea of like flipping the switch came from that essay, that speech, "This Is Water."
Right. Yeah. It was a commencement address at Kenyon College.
Right. But it sounds great, but you're right though. Cause like what it does is you're just basically living reality in your head again. Like you have to create this reality in your head that might not even exist.
Oh, right. And, you know, and then like, what are you supposed to do? Kind of come up with the worst case scenario for every situation so that you make sure that you are kind of, you know, deferring your own needs and desires to the worst possible response that someone else might have to it. You know, it becomes this kind of like this like rat race for worst case scenarios. And so even the burden itself becomes its own burden, as you imagine, like even worse and worse and worse explanations for why other people or other situations are behaving in a way that you can't respond to, when you could be focusing all that energy and just actually working with the world, doing things with the materials that are given to you. But of course, it requires like retraining ourselves, not just, you know, in order that we don't get annoyed with the slow driver in front of us or something, which is, you know, where Wallace's examples mostly live. But like with the act of driving itself, or the act of shopping itself, or the act of, you know, cleaning up the leaves that are falling from the trees, all of that stuff that we think of as chaff, you know, it has to become meat. There has to be some way that we can learn to attend to those opportunities and treat them as opportunities rather than as seeing them as these things that then we'd have to invent stories about in order that we could tolerate being around them.
Right. So you make the case that one response that we've gone to in our modern day to handle this existential pressure, this angst of so much choice and FOMO is irony. Irony carries a lot of hip social cachet today. Everyone's trying to be ironic and be meta. And I'll admit that like I sometimes do, I'll do that. But I hate myself after I do it. I'm like, why? It's so dumb. So let's start off. How do you describe irony? Because I think Alanis Morissette might have steered people in the wrong direction.
Yeah,
what irony is,
you know, in its kind of original meaning, irony in its kind of literary sense is language that says the opposite of what it means, but it's actually become something slightly different. And and now what irony means is saying or doing something in a way that prevents others from knowing if you even meant to mean it or not to mean it. You know,
yeah.
So, like, when you wear the trucker cap or drink PBR or, you know, post an Instagram of some strange flavor of potato chips that you found, or whatever it is that you do, right? Riding the fixie bike, all of these sort of silly tropes of hipster irony. It's not so much that they are treating things as these kind of fetishes. It's rather that you can't tell. You can never tell whether you or anyone else means to mean that they are attached and interested in those things, or that they mean to spurn them and scorn them and kind of sneer at them. So it's that like undecidability, that uncertainty of knowing whether something is sincere or contemptuous that characterizes a contemporary irony. And, you know, it's no surprise that we found ourselves in this situation because we have just all of this stuff, all of this surplus of ideas and things and information and encounters, and in the face of that surplus, right, we're still not able to find pleasure and delight in our lives. We have all of the things that we could possibly want, and yet we still find them. We still find them wanting. And so, you know, we recognize that kind of under the surface that there's this inconsistency, and one response to it is to kind of hold things at this distance. You know, they threaten us that things might go awry. I'm not sure if, you know, if that new IPA is going to be pleasurable or not. So I'll just kind of talk about what a silly name it has on the internet. And some of that anxiety, that ironic anxiety, does come from real social concern, and you know, I think we're living in this time of austerity, even as we are also living in a time of great surplus. And I think the rise of irony, you know, with the rise of the internet, also corresponds with austerity and with the kind of economic collapse of the post 2008 Great Recession, and all of these things that we once were able to take for granted, at least to some extent, many of those have fallen away. And so our fear is somewhat founded. Our fear that things might kind of you know, bite us in the brain for having thought about them. There are reasons why, there are good reasons why that anxiety exists, but we've extended that anxiety to kind of everything whatsoever through this ironic distance, this detachment from things.
So the irony allows us to hedge our bets, right? Like
it's a hedge. Yeah. It allows you to hedge your bets. You know, I might or might not come back to this and treat it for what it is. And then of course, by doing so, we ensure that we never will.
Right. Right. And how does the internet, rocket boost this sense of irony that we have that, in our culture?
Yeah, almost everything we do online is ironic to some extent. Some of it is more ironic than others. So any meme or sort of, you know, image that you see online can very quickly enter that ironic mode. You know, someone photoshops an image of something in order to turn it into something else, or you know, you've got infinite numbers of like a Trump or Hillary photos after the debates that then get, you know, turned into their own memes that then get turned into still further memes, and then people screenshot the tweets or the Facebook posts of other people saying things that they find ridiculous or absurd and transform those into these, you know, all of these like layers upon layers upon layers of reconsumption and distancing. And you know, the pop cultural version of this is also quite common. You know, the tendency that we have to talking about things. Oh, you know, here's a television show or a video game or whatever it is, and it can always produce these sort of images or GIFs or what have you that allow you to kind of take a portion of it and use it as a joke or a gag that appears to be engaging deeply with the material, but also distances. But actually distances you from you know, really treating it for what it is. And you know, through that exercise of like meme making and internet trips and so forth, we've also ironized kind of ourself and our relationship to others just as much. And you don't even know anymore. Like someone says something to you online, and you know, there's the old joke about on the internet, nobody knows you're a dog. But in fact, you don't know that you don't know that someone's a dog or not. You're not sure. Maybe they're a dog, maybe they're not. You can't take something seriously because it might be in jest, or even if it was serious, then the you know, your interlocutor might say, "Oh no, I was just kidding. You misunderstood me." So we live in this kind of vat where online where we're never really sure what's happening or why. And part of it is because we don't know anything about many of the folks that we encounter in this sort of an anonymity of online life. But also, even when we start to, there's just a whole barrage, another wave of new material comes pouring out as our screens scroll through the new content on Facebook or Instagram or what have you. So the internet has just amplified that existing sense of irony that was already present. And because we spend so much of our lives online, you know, we have to do work and you have to interact with your friends and your family online. It's impossible to avoid. You just can't avoid it anymore.
Right, right. And yeah, when I was reading that, it made me think of the Three Wolves t-shirt howling at the moon. That was a great example from a few years ago. So I think a lot of people actually liked the t-shirt, but like they couldn't say they liked the t-shirt because that wouldn't be cool. So they hedged their bets by saying, "Well, I'm wearing this thing, but isn't it funny? Ha ha."
Oh, right. It was a good example. Yeah, that sort of, you know, it was ironic to wear it, but then it was ironic to talk about not wearing it, or maybe you were wearing it, maybe you just photoshopped it onto yourself so you didn't really have to wear it. And I think the t-shirt is one of the prime examples because it's so easy to make a t-shirt now that you find t-shirts for everything. It used to be actually quite difficult to get something onto a t-shirt. You know, it was time and expense. You have to silk screen it. But we have all these services that we can use, which you know, so we have all this, like infrastructure, this infrastructure for irony that we can tap into. And I'm just as guilty of this, you know, as anybody. It's so tempting and so easy to do. Someone makes a quip online and you take a screen. I did this just the other week. Like, you know, someone said something and I took the screenshot and put it on a t-shirt that you could get on one of those on-demand printing services. You know, it's so easy to do that that then of course, you know, the person I was talking to went and bought the t-shirt and took a picture. And on the one hand, there's this opportunity to kind of engage with the conversation that we're having, but on the other hand, it's it's easier just to kind of hold it at this distance or to kind of cover it in plastic, like, you know, like your grandma's sofa, in order that you don't have to engage with it. And instead you can talk about the idea of engaging with it instead.
Right. And it's, I mean, it's a solution that we've gone to sort of deal with this infinite choice that we have. But
well, it works in the short term. It always works in the short term because you can kind of go, ha ha, look what I did. You know, look how I made a joke out about the world. And then everyone laughs and you get a bunch of likes or retweets or whatever it is you're looking for. And then, you know, 5 minutes pass and it doesn't make you any happier or more content. You just have to find another source of that material. It's almost like the logic of addiction.
Right, right. So it's not a long-term solution.
It's not a long-term solution. And then it's not even a short-term solution in the sense that you're not taking delight in the joy of the Three Wolves shirt either, right? You're neither building a kind of platform through which you could develop a long-term interest and meaning in something, nor are you developing a method by which you could get pleasure in these all these random individual things that are constantly scrolling by us.
Right, right. And how do most folks combat this irony? And why does like the way they usually approach it or try to combat it fail?
So you know, there's this term I coined in the book, ironoia, which is sort of like paranoia for things, right? So if paranoia is the mistrust of people, then ironoia is the mistrust of things. And that act of distancing, of sort of holding things at arm's length, you know, and saying, okay, well, you know, there's something, but I'm going to just wait and see if something better comes along, or perhaps I mistrust that it might be of use or of interest to me. That maneuver is like half right. And the half of it that's right is in like stopping, you know, stopping your ordinary life and your ordinary attention and noting that there's something before you in the universe, right? Like, okay, here's this shirt, or here's this person, or here's this problem, or here's this task that I have to do, whatever it is. And then circumscribing it, you know, saying I'm gonna draw a circle around this so that I can focus on it. But then the ironic maneuver, what it does is says, okay, I've captured it, you know, I've sealed it inside of this bubble, like plastic wrap, like I'm gonna put it on the shelf. And now I can dispose of it. You know, I've successfully captured whatever that thing is in the world, and I've caught it. It's not going to be a further. It's not going to do me further harm. And I'll just dispose of it as quickly as possible and move on to the next thing. So the half that's right, you know, the kind of approach that's right is in recognizing things as they exist. But then instead of casting them aside, you know, waiting for the next thing to come along, you want to take that thing and begin to work with it, to manipulate it.
Okay,
to figure out what you can do with it.
All right, so let's talk about that. So, I mean, your solution to that is you play with it, right?
You play with it.
Right. But I think the way most people define play is not exactly how, I mean, it's not exactly how you define play. So how do you define play? Or what do you mean by play?
Yeah, most of the time when we hear play, we think it's like the opposite of work. You know, play is what you get to do after you're done with what you have to do. Play is this... this experience of freedom or of being unfettered, you know, not being kind of held down by obligation or duty. And instead, I would suggest thinking of play not as the opposite of work, but as this thing that exists in materials. So one good analogy for this that we actually talk about as play is the play that's present in a mechanism, you know, like a steering column. There's a little bit of play in the mechanism before it engages and begins turning the wheel. Or if you think about other domains in which we use the word play for instruments. We play instruments. You play the guitar. You play the piano. It's not that you're like doing whatever you want with the guitar or the piano. That doesn't make any sense whatsoever. When you play the guitar, you're taking its material properties, the strings and the fretboard and the body of it, and you're holding it in a certain way, and you're manipulating it to produce the sounds that it's capable of. And through that manipulation, you can produce music. That's what it means to play. So if you take that kind of analogy of the way that you play the guitar and you apply it to anything else, anything whatsoever, and then play is a process of evaluating, understanding, and then responding to the material properties of things. So seeing what you can do with them, how you can incorporate them into your experience, and how you can treat them based on the constraints and limitations that they present to you, rather than kind of seeing them as these potential tools through which to achieve your own desires.
Did you know Fast Growing Trees is the biggest online nursery in the U.S. with more than 10,000 different kinds of plants and over 2 million happy customers in the United States? They have everything you could possibly want, like fruit trees, palm trees, evergreens, houseplants, and so much more. Fast Growing Trees makes it easy to order online, and your plants are shipped directly to your door in 1 to 2 days. So I got a tree from Fast Growing Trees. I had a tree in my front yard that had to cut down, a big giant oak tree, because it died, and I wanted to put a maple tree there, one that turned this bright red during the fall. So I found that tree, made sure that it fit the climate that we're at here in Tulsa, Oklahoma, ordered it. A few days later, I got the tree in a box. It's crazy they can send a tree in a box, and I planted it. A few weeks after I planted it, it's already starting to sprout leaves. So I think in a few years, I'm going to have that bright red maple tree that happens in the fall. I'm really looking forward to that. So if you want to try Fast Growing Trees out, this spring they have the best deals online, up to half off on select plants and other deals. And listeners to our show get an additional 15% off with their first purchase when using code manliness at checkout. That's an additional 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com using code manliness at checkout. Fastgrowingtrees.com, code manliness. Offers valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions may apply. Texas Pete is the sauce that allows you to sauce like you mean it. Each Texas Pete sauce is packed with a bold, balanced flavor. The signature tanginess is what makes it a legendary hot sauce that can be used on just about anything. You're definitely going to want to try every flavor. The original hot sauce has a famous secret blend of fermented peppers. Their hotter hot sauce is 3 times hotter than the original, and it's not for the faint of heart. They also got a flavor called Sabor by Texas Pete, adds authentic Mexican flavor. And they also have a dust dry seasoning that matches the flavor of the original hot sauce in a flavorful dry rub. But the flavor that I've been enjoying lately is the Chop Sriracha sauce. It's got chili, garlic, and some tropical tangy notes. It's really good. I love putting on my eggs. Texas Pete, sauce like you mean it. Visit TexasPete.com and use the store locator to find Texas Pete products, as well as purchase sauces and get recipe inspiration. And you can use promo code PODCAST24 for 20% off at TexasPete.com. That's PODCAST24 for 20% off at TexasPete.com. Check out the Sriracha Cha Sauce. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now, and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy-to-follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. Have you ever been to an event where you just had to get the best seats? Like maybe it was a concert for your favorite band, or maybe it was an important game for your favorite team. Well, to do that, you had to set an alarm to get the tickets as soon as they went on sale. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you are trying to hire for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast, and right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best people fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness, MANLINESS. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
As if you even knew what you wanted.
Right. So let's kind of take a step back here. So like going back, so we play in playgrounds. Like you make this analogy of playgrounds, and playgrounds are sort of these areas, like we'll talk about like a typical playground you see at the park. It's an area where you engage in play, but you say you can create playgrounds anywhere. Like a playground would be the musical instrument, right? Like you have this, they have these strings, they have frets, they have this board, and you have to that's the playground. You have this constraint that you have to deal with. And then by dealing with that constraint, you can actually create something pretty cool.
Right. And if you were to sort of reject it, if you say, well, this is preposterous. Look at this idiotic object that someone claims I can play music with. You know, obviously I can't. Like and this is what happens when you pick up something like a guitar for the first time, or a piano, or a set of golf clubs, is they're hard. And they resist you because they're not that concerned about your pleasure, the pleasure you derive from using them. And in order to make good on them, you know, you have to engage with it. You have to take it seriously for a while. Okay, like how do I learn to play the guitar? What do I need to know about it? What have other people done before me? How does it actually operate? And then over time, you can develop this relationship with it. And, you know, some people would say, well, you know, that's a guitar, but you can't possibly do that with, you know, errands or commuting or what have you. But I think that's absolutely false. You can do it with anything. The trick is in delivering, bringing that deep attention and commitment to it in the first place, which is where the idea of the playground, you know, is useful. You see kids do this all the time. Kids are just like so good at finding play in anything. And you can think of the playground as like a physical enclosure, like you see in the park, but it's also a conceptual one. You know, like if you send your kids outside, you're like, go play outside, and they'll run outside, and then, you know, very quickly kind of say, okay, what's here? Oh, there's some sticks. What are these sticks? Oh, let's make up some rules about what the sticks are for, what they do. And then taking into account like the material properties of the stick as a thing that could be a sword, or that, you know, you could throw, or what have you. And that sort of activity is possible with anything. It just requires, you know, being willing and open to seeing it for what it is, and asking how you can manipulate it, how you can play it.
Right. So I mean, it sounds like what people do with irony, they make the playground, right? They like kind of take this object, they see it, and they put a boundary around it. But then they just, like you said, stop. Throw it away. They stop there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, the first maneuver that ends up being an ironic one is to you know, to take something and kind of remove it from the world, to draw this playground or this circumscription around it, to say, huh, here's the thing before me. That thing could, you know, I'm worried about it. It couldn't possibly produce the pleasure it promises, or that it doesn't promise. Let's just talk about the idea that it might, and then let's dispose of it. But if you engage with it really deeply, if you sort of accept that invitation to enter that sphere and take it seriously, then you find just impossible depth. You know, one of the examples I have in the book is the McDonald's Filet-O-Fish sandwich, which is a favorite of mine. And there was this story a number of years ago about like how to make your own Filet-O-Fish sandwich at home. It's a great example of a moment online that could go toward irony or could go toward play. And, you know, the kind of ironizing move is to do this in order that you can kind of laugh at the low quality food at McDonald's, or that you can take a picture of it. Haha, I made a filet of fish at home, or that you can kind of suspend this sense of whether you mean to sort of exalt or to scorn the sandwich by talking about it or making it in your own kitchen. But the truth is that it's actually super interesting to understand how industrial food is made and where it comes from and how you might recreate it in your own kitchen. And by engaging with it in that serious way, even something as preposterous as a fast food sandwich, you've discovered something new about the world. And that discovery of novelty is where the contentment comes from, if you allow it to percolate.
You quoted this one, I think it was philosopher or anthropologist, where he makes the case that play is actually the driving force of human culture.
Yeah, if you think of play in this very general way, that, you know, play is the process of encircling something and then manipulating the contents that are within it, then all we're really doing when we produce culture is playing. It's just that it's not play as this kind of release or as the opposite of work or of duty. It's play as the serious and deliberate manipulation of the materials that we find. And you know, when you think about some of the examples, this is a Dutch anthropologist named Johan Huizinga, and one of the examples that Huizinga uses is the courtroom. You know, so the courts are a stage of play, and they actually have something very much in common with the theater in some sense. This was one of the reasons why we like to watch courtroom dramas on television. In fact, we kind of have individuals, the judge and the jury and the attorneys and so forth, who are playing roles, and they are speaking and using the rules of law in a way that's different from the way that we ordinarily use language and performance in day-to-day life. And through that manipulation, legal code, of rhetoric, of performance, they create a very real outcomes, right? This is a serious context. And you don't necessarily need a serious context like that to understand how play produces culture, rather to understand that when you see play as this process of manipulating what you find, rather than this process of escaping the world into the dreams in your own head, then you're always being productive when you do it. You're always being productive when you perform it.
Right. So it's interesting. You brought the courtroom. There's these roles, these defined words you're supposed to say. So there's constraints, which makes it awesome, right? Like we don't, like as you said, most people think of play as like, oh, you just do whatever you want. But you say in order for play to be actually fun, we'll talk about what fun means, there has to be constraints. And I thought it was interesting. You argue in the book that the way we often go about trying to improve our lives is through restraints. Can you talk about the difference between restraints and constraints and why constraints are the better way to go?
Yeah. So we're obsessed with asceticism suddenly, right? Like, and it's one of the responses to this world of plenty that we live in, right? Oh, you know, I should really exercise more. You know, I want to do this thing, but I'm going to try to resist doing it because it would be better for me to do this other thing. You know, those are these sort of negative and potentially ironizing moves that the logic of restraint demands that we perform. And if you kind of flip that on its head and you instead accept the natural sorts of constraint that are built into the things that we find, which are sometimes exactly the same things, right? Like it's not that I'm going to resist eating cake. It's that, oh, if I'm interested in a certain kind of diet, then I'm going to stock my pantry and kitchen with the kinds of foods I want to eat. Let me figure out how I'm going to go and find those and purchase them in a way that puts the right stuff around me such that when I go to eat thing, I'm eating the things I want, right? Or, the act of constraint that you accept when you enter the sphere of a game, right? The pitch or the playground. If you find yourself on the football or the soccer field and you say, well, you know, I just refuse to accept the rules of the game, then you're not playing. But by accepting those constraints, you're able to enter into the experience of sport. And if you stop yourself as you watch a soccer or a football game and you go, this is ridiculous. Like what are these people doing? They could do anything they want. You know, why are they adhering to the rules of the game? It doesn't make any sense. This is what makes the game what it is. So by looking for, accepting, and even inventing and applying new constraints to our lives, we can flip this ironizing tendency to try to restrain ourselves, like, oh, I'm not going to have that second glass of wine, or, you know, I really shouldn't do this, into a method of structuring our behavior around the limitations that we've either deliberately set up or that we've accepted in the world that we find. You know, one example of a set of constraints is the constraints of the people and things that we find in our daily lives, right? The actual properties of our family or our significant others, the actual properties of our homes or our jobs. And we complain about those things all the time, right? Oh, if only my wife or my husband didn't do this thing, then things would be better in my marriage. Or, you know, if only my job weren't so miserable, then I wouldn't hate going to it. And, you know, even despite those sensations, you can always kind of flip them on their head and figure out, okay, well, like, what are the properties of those circumstances? What are the limitations and constraints that I can work within? What can I do in these situations rather than how can I obsess over what is impossible?
Right. So, yeah, accept the world as it is and work with it, deal with it in a way.
Right. And, you know, of course, there's a point at which, you know, accepting the world becomes absurd or unpalatable or even destructive. So it's not kind of like a fatalistic suggestion that, you know, just take everything that already exists. That's all that there can be. We can always alter that world, too. But we have the sense that that we kind of have to dispose of things much more rapidly than we really need to. And so we fail to accept and to evaluate, to find the constraints that are present and to work within them. And instead, we kind of move immediately to rejection. And, you know, because there's so many other options now, there's so many other options for everything. Oh, you don't like, you know, that beer or that shampoo, there's another one. You didn't like this potential significant other, no problem. You know, just swipe and find another one. That we've kind of enculturated ourselves to that notion of rejection rather than admitting the opportunity to stop and say, okay, like, I'm going to treat this for what it is for a minute, see if there's anything more that I can find. And then inevitably there is. There's always these hidden depths and things once you allow yourself to discover them.
The other problem with restraint is that it's exhausting. It's like existentialism. It's like trying to come up with meaning, like restraining yourself all the time. just exhaust you, and it ends up failing in the long run.
And how many things can you reject before you're out of things? And then you've got to find new things, which you then have been in the habit of rejecting, and so you reject them too. And you know, changing that attitude from restraint to constraint is difficult, but we have these models for it. And you know, games and play are one of the places we can look for those models. They are places where we a game is a place where you accept the arbitrary absurdity of the world. And instead of rejecting it, you say, okay, like, I'm going to take it for what it is and mess around with it. And that's what play is. And if we can bring that same attitude to ordinary life, not just to entertainment or not just to sport or not just to the places where we normally think of play as taking place, then we can apply that same attitude, that same strategy for seeking pleasure to ordinary things as much as extraordinary ones.
Right. So you talk about in the book, the result of play is fun. Like, usually we put the two together. Well, it's not play if you're not having fun. If you're not having fun, well, I'm going to stop doing this thing because it's not playful. But fun is a word that gets thrown around quite a bit, and we kind of use it just sort of as this filler, just to describe things, even though we don't really mean it was fun. It was just sort of interesting. So how do most people use fun, and how do you define fun?
Fun is one of these amazing words that means almost nothing. If you stop yourself the next time you find yourself saying fun, or you hear someone saying something was fun, and kind of ask, well, what am I saying? What do they mean? You'll quickly realize, I'm not sure. You know, we have this intuitive sense that fun means pleasure, that fun is a kind of synonym for pleasure. Something was pleasurable, something was fun, and that's what we desire most, is to have fun, to gain pleasure from things. But in fact, many of the experiences that we describe as fun, they tend to be actually quite difficult, even kind of miserable. You know, you come back in from a long run or a difficult day at the office, you've taken some gratification in the work that you've done. It was harrowing, but nevertheless, it was positive. Something pleasurable emerged from it, and so that idea of fun is this sort of lightweight, easy pleasure. It just turns out to be totally wrong. And if you kind of dig under it, what you find instead is that, you know, fun is like a placeholder for naming a process of discovering something new in something familiar. Fun is that process of discovery of novelty. And the reason it's such a lightweight or thrown around placeholder term is because we tend not to be able to see and discover those moments, especially when they occur in ordinary life, when they're not part of something remarkable. You know, you go out for an evening or like after dinner drinks or whatever, or you're hanging out with some friends or some coworkers or whatever, and you get back home, and your roommate or your spouse or whatever says, you know, how was it? Oh yeah, I had fun. It's like, what you really mean by that is that, you know, you found yourself in a situation that was the same one that you did last week, that you've done a million times, but there was still something new, or there's still something to learn about your friends, or there's still something interesting to be had in commiserating about life at the office, or there's still something interesting and novel to discover about the exact same path that you take on your jog or on your bicycle route. And that's what fun is. It's the discovery of novelty, and especially the discovery of novelty in the almost sickening context of familiarity. When you can dig through and under familiarity and still find something new, that's where fun comes from.
Right. So it's like taking a look at the playgrounds in our lives, the conceptual and the real ones, and then playing in them, and then finding new things in the playground that you didn't see before.
Which demands repetition, right? I mean, this is one of the features of games, is that they're very repetitive. You go back again and again, you do the same things over and over and over again, rather than trying them once and then kind of, you know, testing whether they're worthwhile and asking, okay, well, if so, I'll continue. If not, I'll give it up because there's something else I could pursue instead. So that need to return to something is part of it's intrinsic to play, and it's also required for fun to emerge. It's very, very easy now not to bother trying something a second time, or to kind of go back and go deeper. But there are many things that we can't resist trying a second time. Like, you're going to have to empty the dishwasher tomorrow, just like you did today. And you're going to have to drive to work tomorrow, like you did today. And you're going to have to balance your checkbook and do your taxes. All of this stuff that we construe as miserable, we still have to do. We have to do it every day. And if we can dig under that familiarity and through play find novelty in those experiences, then they can be just as fun as the supposedly delightful activities that we pursue in order to seek pleasure.
That's awesome. So part of the subtitle of your book is The Pleasures of Boredom. Why? I mean, we often think that boredom is terrible. That's how people get into trouble. Boredom is what leads to people to the bottle, to porn, to all these sort of distractions to distract them from the boredom. But you argue boredom's a good thing. Why is boredom a good thing?
Boredom is a sign. It's a signal. It's like a flare that goes up that says, okay, you know, now you're ready to start. When you find yourself bored, you've kind of expended all the obvious choices. You know, you've done the easy things, and now the work can start in really determining what's in a situation, what something means. So, you know, one of the places that you might find yourself bored is at work, or you know, in your car, or you know, you've got to go out and do errands, or one of the examples I use in the book is the long haul flight. You know, at 14 hours on a plane, and you know, you start and you kind of do all the things that aren't being on a plane. You watch the movies, and you eat the food, and you read a book, and you listen to music, and play some games, and you do all this stuff that's meant to distract you from the experience of being stuck in this metal tube 5 miles above Earth, hurtling through space at 500 miles an hour. And then once you kind of get over that, once you've done all the things that are not being in a plane just by being in a plane, then you're faced with its reality. And that's terrifying. It's one of the reasons why when we feel bored, and we also feel anxiety. I don't know who I am. I don't know what I'm going to do next. And that's where the fear begins to come from. But when you find boredom kind of percolating up into your brain, it's a good sign that that you've done all the easy work. You've sort of expended the obvious choices. And then the invitation of boredom is to look again, you know, rather than to kind of go, okay, there's nothing more to do here. I got to go find something else, to look again. You know, what else can be played? What are the other opportunities that are presented by the experience you find yourself in? And often, you know, that is the kind of prerequisite to finding meaning. You know, after you get through the easy tasks of doing whatever it is that you do in your job over and over and over again, you know, then you can say, okay, how could I improve this? Or why am I even doing these things in the first place? Let me try to go find out. Or how could I make it better? Or even like, okay, well, maybe I need to be doing something else entirely. All of those kinds of revelations almost require you first to face boredom, and then through boredom to direct your attention to what might overcome it, what might be possible in the face of that boredom.
So let's put these principles into action. We've kind of done it a bit. We've given some examples throughout the conversation, but like, let's take the airplane example, right? So you're bored, you've done all the low hanging fruit, you've read, you played your games, you're still on the plane. How do you play, right? How do you approach the airplane with a playful mindset?
Right. And you know, the airplane is like, it's my kryptonite almost. I find it so difficult. And so, you know, as an example, it's an interesting exercise, I think, for all of us, because, you know, what it means to be on a plane is, you know, to face the sense of being crushed inside of your seat, or to be next to someone that you maybe do or don't want to talk to, or to ask what the magazine says that you might read instead of pursuing some other activity. All of those kinds of like little seemingly meaningless activities, right? They're kind of what make flight what it is. Even like the cramped bathroom with the strange smell, walking down the aisle uncomfortably and being kind of tilted off your feet by turbulence. You know, those kind of small experiences, as they add up, they produce this sort of sum total effect of being on the plane. Now, you know, maybe this isn't something that, you know, you can kind of do over and over again, or that you even find yourself in a situation where it matters, but it's an exercise. It's like an exercise you perform in order that you can do it later with anything else. So I'll give you another example, which comes from many of the examples in the book, you know, just come from my own life, because if the premise I'm advancing is that you need to find a way for your ordinary life to be meaningful, then I better be able to look in my ordinary life to find meaning. So one of the things that I've, you know, been facing in my community is a few years ago I got like kind of accidentally involved in local local land use politics. And this sounds like the most boring thing ever, right? Like zoning and all of the kind of regulations of zoning variances and how to change zoning. And then, you know, how to manage approvals for new and old construction in a historic district. And these sorts of activities, as I was thrust into them, they just seemed like overwhelming, ridiculous. But as I got more and more involved in this process of sort of, you know, being a citizen member of a community and engaging with the aspects of planning the development of the future of my neighborhood and my city and my county and so forth, I realized, like there's this whole universe underneath where I wanted to stop, you know, and the place I wanted to stop was, oh, somebody wants to build something I don't like or something, right? But in fact, you know, once you dig below that, you realize, there's actually a whole jolly people that are urban planners, and there's a whole universe of knowledge that you could do your whole career around this. Like, who am I to kind of cast it aside and pretend like there's nothing meaningful to be found there? And as I begin to understand the constraints and limitations, you know, legal, dealing with individuals in the community, managing the time that's required to kind of meet with a builder or to figure out how to you know, get something done on the calendar of the planning commission, all of these sorts of things, those became the aspects of play. And you know, it takes a bit of squinting, it takes a bit of work before you can kind of see these supposed nuisances, like, you know, like dealing with land use politics, as a game like anything else.
Right. And I even, like, I've, you know, I read the book just a few weeks ago, but like even just like trying to like do, you know, squint and try to find those things, it's helped me look at things that I otherwise would have thought of as a nuisance, as like that is an opportunity to like play with it, and it suddenly becomes not such a nuisance. It's actually kind of fun.
It becomes an opportunity, because what else were you going to be doing with your time? You know, and every time I find myself faced with something that it's either boredom or it's nuisance, where those are the sensations that kind of well up in me, then I just try to kind of stop and say, oh, okay, well, like, what more is there that I'm not seeing? You know, like my sink, my kitchen sink got clogged a few weeks back, like pretty seriously clogged. And you know, I've become reasonably handy over my life, but this was really puzzling me. And so, you know, you can get annoyed. Instead of watching TV, now I have to clear the sink. But this is an opportunity to understand something else about how plumbing works. I can kind of improve my competence in DIY home maintenance, and through doing so also learn something more about how my particular sink is constructed, and maybe if it's not constructed properly, I could pursue the remedy of that either through my own hands or by hiring my plumber, which, you know, then also requires you to find a plumber that you want to use. So like all of those like little moments, even though they seem like just like detritus, the things that we don't want to think about so we can get on to the good stuff, there's still meaning there too. It's just that you have to treat it as such.
Right. And as you said earlier, this isn't a fatalistic approach. Like you don't necessarily have to accept everything the way it is, right? There's sometimes you have to just like take the reality that, or the ideal in your head, and you actually have to make that a reality, because like the current reality is completely unacceptable.
Yeah. And you know, play, it doesn't mean accepting all of the conditions of a particular set of constraints forever. Like, you know, as if they were sort of brought down from the mountain or dictated by fate. Play can also involve applying new conditions, new constraints, new limitations, or disposing of old ones. And this is like minor or major matters. You know, the kind of play that involves remedying the leaky faucet that I just mentioned. It's not like, well, you know, this is my life. My sink's going to leak and it's going to be clogged and that's all I can do. You know, no, I have to involve something else. I have to introduce new concepts and new materials into the playground that is my sink. And the same is true of much weightier, you know, matters. If you think about, you know, like social conditions or injustices that you want to remedy because the limitations of living in a world of racial violence, for example, are unacceptable, you know, then it's not that you say, well, that's it, you know, there's nothing I could do about it. It's that you have to muster kind of a different imaginary circle, different playground around those elements of the world, and then say, well, how could we manipulate them differently to produce a different outcome?
Right. So you create a new playground. That's what you're doing.
Yeah, but you know, like to make that change in the first place, to make that new playground, you first start by acknowledging the reality that you want to change. You have to treat it for what it is. And part of that process is accepting and understanding the circumstances rather than denying them.
Awesome. Well, Ian, this has been a great conversation. Where can people learn more about your book?
Yeah. So, you know, the book's available at your favorite bookseller, and you can also check out my website at bogost.com, bogost.com. There's information about the book and links to other conversations and articles I've written that are on the same theme.
All right, Ian Bogost, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
My guest today is Ian Bogost. He's the author of the book, Play Anything. It's available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. You can also find more information about Ian's work at bogost.com. And also check out the show notes at aom.is/bogost for links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. Our show is edited by Creative Audio Lab here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. If you have any audio editing needs or audio production needs, check them out at creativeaudiolab.com. And if you have a moment, I'd really appreciate it if you give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. That really helps us out a lot. As always, I appreciate your continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.